Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Arielle Gold, National Co-Director of Code Pink Women for Peace, who talks about her group's campaign to pressure Senate Democrats to amend the National Defense Authorization Act in order to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. Investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, who discusses his current investigation into Ohio and Georgia's purge of hundreds of thousands of voter registrations, depriving large numbers of people of color their right to vote. And Laura Berry, Research and Publications Director with the Climate Mobilization, who explains what, in her organization's view, must be done to avert climate catastrophe. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Hours after the Trump administration's envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, announced an agreement in principle with the Taliban to withdraw 5,400 U.S. troops, a suicide bomber targeted the Green Village compound, which houses several international organizations and guest houses in Kabul. The Taliban claimed credit for the bombing, which killed 16 and injured 100 people. In a process long criticized for its secrecy, the U.S. Taliban talks have excluded the Afghan government, civil society, and women's rights groups. In exchange for the withdrawal of U.S. forces, the Taliban pledged not to allow Afghanistan to become a future base for foreign fighters to attack Western interests. For weeks, critics have complained that the Taliban had not made any real concessions and are simply biding their time until the U.S. military leaves the country. The U.S. currently has about 14,000 troops in Afghanistan. News reports said the U.S. Taliban negotiations discussed the withdrawal of the remaining U.S. troops on the condition of holding future talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, as well as establishing a ceasefire. Officials in the government of Afghan President Ashraf Ghani objected to conditions in the agreement with the Taliban, and Ghani canceled a planned trip to Washington, D.C. As violent attacks by both the Taliban and its rival, the Islamic State, have escalated, Afghanistan's presidential election is set for September 28th. California Governor Gavin Newsom and the state's top legislative leaders are advocating a housing bill to establish rent and eviction protections for some 3 million vulnerable tenants. The legislation would impose a cap on rent increases of 5% plus inflation annually over the next decade, beyond what was accepted by the powerful California Association of Realtors. The move comes 1 year after California voters rejected a state referendum that would have expanded rent control regulations. The proposed legislation would extend protection to renters outside of San Francisco and Los Angeles, where apartments are already under rent control. The bill, which will be voted on in September, would limit tenant evictions to lease violations and would require relocation assistance for renters. The Los Angeles-based AIDS Healthcare Foundation is now collecting signatures to place a new rent control referendum on the November 2020 ballot. Foundation Director Michael Weinstein has said he'd pull the initiative if legislators agree to strong renter protections, but he remains committed to his own measure because he says the 5% cap on rent increases was still too high and won't end the state's homelessness crisis. In late August, 20,000 AT&T workers went on a 4-day strike over basic demands for human freedom and dignity in 9 of the 13 states that once made up the Civil War-era Confederacy. In their job action, workers confronted the legacy of Jim Crow laws, which over the decades have mutated into an extreme form of anti-unionism called right-to-work laws. The AT&T strike was called by the Communication Workers of America Union Local 3120 in response to managers disciplining workers for wearing pro-union insignia during contract negotiations. Over 300 telephone line workers attended an emergency union meeting and quickly endorsed the strike. The AT&T job action follows other recent strikes over working conditions in the American South. A year ago, 34,000 West Virginia teachers went on strike, closing every school in the state for 9 days. By calling strikes, sometimes over union officials' objections, workers have been reviving the strike as the labor movement's most powerful tool. Longtime union organizer Jay McAlevey is urging union activists to renew efforts to repeal the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act by including domestic and agricultural workers who are primarily women and workers of color, and to push for the recognition of contract and part-time workers whose numbers are surging in today's tech workforce. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As the bloody war in Yemen grinds on, civilians continue to be the target of indiscriminate attacks by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in their fight against Houthi rebels they claim are supported by Iran. The U.S. has backed the Saudi-led war by supplying weapons, as well as logistics and intelligence support. The conflict in Yemen has killed between 50 and 100,000 people since 2015. According to a United Nations report, 80% of the Yemeni population, 24 million people, is now in need of humanitarian assistance due to the Saudi-UAE blockade of food and medical supplies and a deadly cholera epidemic. A recent UN investigation also found that the U.S., Britain, and France may be complicit in war crimes committed in Yemen. Over the past year, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress has worked to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war. In April, both the House and Senate passed a historic war powers resolution to end the U.S. role in the Saudi-led Yemen war, but the measure was later vetoed by President Trump. Now four Democrats in Congress, Senators Jack Reed and Chuck Schumer, Representative Adam Smith and Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have an opportunity to include amendments in this year's must-pass National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, that prohibits support and participation in the Saudi-led coalition military operations in Yemen. Your reporter spoke with Arielle Gold, National Co-Director of Code Pink Women for Peace, who talks about her group's current campaign to pressure Senate Democrats to amend the U.S. military budget in order to end U.S. complicity in the war in Yemen.
Well, the situation in Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet. Since 2015, when the war began, over 85,000 children under the age of 5 have died as a result of malnutrition from the war. And the U.S., from the beginning, has been largely complicit from providing intelligence to the Saudis, to enormous numbers of weapons sales, as well as the mid-air refueling of Saudi warplanes. Just a little over a year ago, the Saudi planes with a bomb from U.S. company Raytheon was dropped on a school bus, young children going on a field trip. There were 44 young children killed in that incident alone. So we've been working, you know, pretty tirelessly to remove U.S. involvement from this war. So for a number of years, we have been working on legislation in Congress to invoke what's called the War Powers Resolution, which says that a war is illegal if Congress hasn't authorized it, which, of course, Congress has not done. And at the beginning of 2019, we finally passed the War Powers Resolution through both the House and Senate. Trump vetoed it. We didn't have enough votes to override the veto, but another mechanism that we do have is the National Defense Authorization Act, which in itself is kind of a challenging piece of legislation because it will increase what is an already bloated Pentagon budget. But because of that, it's considered to be veto-proof. So any amendments that are attached to it, of which there are many, will be ensured to go through. So we do have a number of amendments, including the Smith-Gahana Yemen War Powers Amendment, which will invoke the War Powers Act. And there's also an amendment as well to block 22 emergency arms sales to Saudi Arabia that Trump is trying to push through right now.
What are the prospects that you'll get the required number of senators to sign on to these amendments that they actually could effectively stop U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the UAE when it comes to prosecuting the war in Yemen?
We definitely would like to get the Smith-Gahana War Powers Resolution through. The interesting thing with the NDAA is that it's already passed through the House and Senate, so now it's that it has to be amended between the two versions. So the important players in this are Senator Jack Reed, as well as Senator Chuck Schumer, Representative Adam Smith, and Speaker Pelosi. So they'll be determining which amendments make it into this final veto-proof version.
What is it that you're asking listeners to do at this point? What can people at large in the country do to support this effort to literally end U.S. cooperation and support for this very bloody war in Yemen?
Absolutely. So I would encourage our listeners to go to codepink.org/NDAA, and you can send a message there to Senators Reid and Schumer and Representatives Adam Smith and Nancy Pelosi. And I would also encourage you to call each of their offices and let them know that the amendments to end the war in Yemen must make it into the final must-pass version of the NDAA.
That was Arielle Gold, National Co-Director of Code Pink Women for Peace. Learn more about the group's current campaign to end the U.S. war in Yemen by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In June 2018, the conservative majority of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ohio's controversial use-it-or-lose-it voting law by a narrow 5-4 margin. The law allows the state to purge voters from the registration rolls if they fail to return a mailed address confirmation form and don't vote for another 4 years or 2 federal election cycles. Earlier this year, Ohio removed 265,000 voters from its voting rolls. Now the state is moving once again to purge an additional 235,000 voters, despite investigations by journalists and voting rights groups that found repeated errors on the state's voter registration list. As a result of a 2016 lawsuit against Republican Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, voters who've been purged will be able to cast provisional ballots in the November 5th election this year and any election through 2022. In 2018, Bryant Kemp, the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia, who was running for governor against Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams, removed over 500,000 voters from the registration rolls in advance of the November 6th election. Investigative reporter and author Greg Palast sued Kemp in federal court and got the names and addresses of all the voters who'd been removed. Palast and his team proved that more than 340,000 voters removed from the rolls were purged improperly, as they hadn't moved from their original registration addresses. Abrams, the first black woman to run for governor in the U.S., lost the election by 50,000 votes, a margin that was most certainly affected by the GOP voter purge. Your reporter spoke with Greg Palast, known for his investigative reports on partisan voter purges going back to the stolen presidential election of 2000 in Florida. Here he discusses his current investigation into both Ohio and Georgia's massive purge of voters and the impact these actions have had on the integrity of elections and democracy itself.
In the case in June of 18, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was okay for Ohio to remove hundreds of thousands of voters, and they just did it again on Friday, 234,000 more voters. on the grounds that they failed to vote, and then they didn't return a postcard. So you miss a couple elections, which some people do. You know, a lot of people didn't feel like voting for who we had on the ballot in 16. A lot of people don't bother with the midterms, especially in black areas where there's no contest. The gerrymandering results in black districts, which are either stacked or cracked, as they say in the biz. They use another word which I can't use on the air, but if it's stacked, they just make it so that a black Democrat wins with 92% of the vote, and they suck out all the black voters and put them in one district, or they crack the district and they scatter black votes in a sea of white votes where they have no influence. So there's a lot of reasons why black folk especially will not vote in midterms if there's no real candidate for them to vote for. There's no contest. Now, this is interesting because the court said they could do that, Scott, that they could do that in Ohio, except for one thing. They said because the National Voter Registration Act says right at the very top, you may not lose your vote for not voting. You have a right to vote in America, and you have a right not to vote. So you may not lose your registration for not voting. So what's going on here? The answer is that the Secretary of State of Ohio, John Husted, said that this was the best way for us to determine if someone has moved. They've left the state. And, of course, if they left the state, they shouldn't vote or be allowed to vote in Ohio. Or if they've left their county of residence, you know, moved from Cleveland to Toledo, well, they got to re-register, so they can't vote in Cleveland because they moved to Toledo. And so that's what the court said. It said, look, according to Mr. Husted, the expert, not voting a couple times, and he sends you a postcard. Hey, all you have to do is fill out the postcard. If you don't fill out a postcard, hey, okay, you've lost your vote because you're not there anymore, clearly. Problem is, Scott, that's a lie, and they know it's a lie. But no one had the evidence that it was a lie, and unless you can prove that that system is racist, unless you prove that that system is false, well, the Husted system, which is kind of what I call purge by postcard, it's legal until you prove it otherwise. And same, we have the same thing in Georgia, where if you didn't vote a couple times and they sent you a postcard, and this guy Brian Kemp, who's running for governor, sent you a postcard, you didn't return Mr. Kemp his postcard, you lost your vote. Same in Georgia as in Ohio, the same exact purging system, which is used in lots of Republican-controlled states. But then we were able to prove that, in fact, they are more than 70% wrong, provably so.
Are actual postcards being sent to these individual voters? It shed some light on actually what the scam is here that you're alleging in terms of a genuine effort is not being made to identify who has moved, who has not moved, who's a legitimate voter, and who's not.
So you asked a very good question. How did this happen? How does this happen? And number one, they say they send out postcards, but in about a third of the cases, they are completely lying. Because when we filed in federal court, Brian Kemp, for example, admitted that well over 100,000 people were never sent postcards. The second thing is the postcard thing is a wonderful Jim Crow trick. It's Jim Crow by mail. Are you ready for this statistic? The Census Bureau tells us that if you are black, urban renter, you are 900% less likely to return a postcard from the government than a white, older, suburban homeowner. And a lot of that has to do with the simple fact that renters move between like a two or three elections, talking like 12-year period, renters move. We had a woman who lost her vote because she moved from one apartment in her building to another apartment in her building, and you can't forward this piece of mail.
We have a critical election coming up in 2020. What are the prospects that many of these people purge from the voting lists in Ohio and in Georgia and other states? What's the prospect that they'll have their vote restored in time for the November 2020 election?
Very little. I'm going to be honest. The courts move slowly. But we're hoping that exposure through the media, that bringing the cases to get more exposure, that having legislative action, that having political action, a lot of it is shedding light on the cockroaches they run through the walls. There is a real simple way to defeat this purge by postcard, a real simple way to defeat cross-check. Re-register. And you're thinking, you're listening, oh, I'm registered. I've been voting in the same place for 20 years. Well, everyone, 3 months before an election, 3-4 months before an election to check to see if you have been removed.
That was Greg Pallast, known for his investigative reports for The Guardian, BBC Television, and Rolling Stone. He's written 4 New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, now a feature documentary. Find links to Pallast's investigations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As weather wreaks climate change-fueled havoc around the world, most recently Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas, more individuals, organizations, and governments are recognizing that the Earth is in fact experiencing a true climate emergency. The destruction wrought by Hurricane Dorian came just weeks before the September 20th global climate strike, worldwide protests demanding action to address climate change. The group Climate Mobilization was founded at the 2014 People's Climate March in New York City by Margaret Klein Solomon, a self-described climate psychologist, and Ezra Silk, with the mission of telling the truth about the climate emergency and the existential risk it poses to humanity and the natural world. The group has called for a World War II-level mobilization to convert the world economy off dependency on fossil fuels. There are now 18 nations and just under 1,000 cities worldwide that have declared a climate emergency, including 29 cities in the U.S., representing 5% of the nation's population. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Laura Berry, Research and Publications Director with the Climate Mobilization. Here she talks about the changing landscape of climate awareness and activism and explains what, in her organization's view, must be done and done immediately to prevent climate catastrophe.
We've been focusing, spreading this concept of climate emergency to get people on board with understanding that this is an emergency situation, that climate change isn't just another sort of political problem or environmental problem that we can deal with through some incremental regulation, but is actually something that is going to fundamentally change the way that we go about our lives. And so we have to sort of take it head on and mobilize together and put an immense amount of resources into tackling the problem. You know, what TCM is trying to do is really to just shift away from this incrementalism that a lot of climate organizations and a lot of politicians who really do care about climate change but don't know what to do about it, shift away from that incrementalism and really make people confront the problem that we can't solve climate change with the same tools that we have, with the same sorts of approaches to policy that we've been using.
Where do you see the climate mobilization, or TCM, fitting into the current climate geography, with recent developments like the Sunrise Movement and its Green New Deal, Extinction Rebellion, and Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager's effort called Fridays for Future?
Absolutely. I mean, I think she said that she doesn't want, you know, people to have hope. She wants them to be afraid. And that actually is something that the TCM, you know, the psychology of climate reality, of climate truth, is what we base a lot of our organizing and our policy work on, because we believe that it does actually take acknowledging that climate change is a fundamental threat to the way that all of our lives are, you know, to really have the reason to take the kind of scale and scope of action that we need. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the concept of shifting into emergency mode, which is what Margaret describes kind of as the point at which an individual or an organization or a government realizes that, you know, this is an emergency situation and, you know, we have to do all that it takes in that moment to deal with the problem that's presenting itself, rather than sort of say, oh, well, the problem's not that bad, or we can deal with it in 2050 rather than right now. You know, and so what TCM is trying to do, I think, is, you know, alongside with groups like Extinction Rebellion and like Sunrise Movement, say that, you know, climate policy and climate politics globally and especially in the United States has been, you know, just the same sort of business as usual and, you know, trying to be politically reasonable, I suppose, about climate change, when in reality, this is the most unreasonable situation that, that humanity has faced ever, and that we really have to start talking about, again, sort of what's necessary rather than what is politically considered feasible.
Laura Berry, how does TCM propose to do that? New Haven, Connecticut, where I live, just declared a climate emergency, and the Board of Alders mandated a task force to figure out next steps. So what does TCM suggest that cities do after they've declared an emergency so it doesn't just sit on a shelf somewhere?
You know, what's happening in New Haven with the convening of a task force to actually try to figure out, okay, how are we going to get to zero emissions by 2030? That is leaps and bounds beyond the vast majority of climate commitments or planning in the United States in general, especially at the local level. And so I think that you're exactly right that we recognize that TCM, that the Climate Emergency Declaration itself is incredibly valuable, but we had to also provide a framework for local organizers to start thinking about, okay, well, what comes after a Climate Emergency Declaration? And we started doing some research and working with local organizers who had been campaigning and realizing that in a lot of places, even in the absence of federal or state sort of climate action, local governments could utilize a lot of different legal and regulatory tools to start sort of building what we call the mobilization, which really is the national World War II scale mobilization of resources. And so what we've developed right now as we're rolling out this new organizer toolkit to start or bring climate emergency campaigns to the next level, we've come up with this post-declaration action framework called Ban, Plan, and Expand. And actually what you've named as something that New Haven is doing is convening, you know, a centralized body, government body, a new structure to actually run this program, this climate mobilization program, to determine what sorts of things locally need to happen in order to get to the 2030 decarbonization deadline. That's a key part of this Ban, Plan, and Expand framework.
That was Laura Berry, Research and Publications Director with the Climate Mobilization. Learn more about the group and its current campaigns by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.